he will warrant more coverage, they said. A spokesman for Mitch McConnell declined to comment. A spokesman for the Fox Corporation also declined to comment, as did a spokeswoman for Donald Trump. The relationship between Donald Trump and the Murdoch media empire has long been complicated. An arrangement of mutual convenience and mistrust that has had sensational ups and downs since Donald Trump first talked himself onto the gossip pages of the New York Post in the 1980s. But the spat between the former president and the media baron, who has helped set the Republican Party's agenda for decades, is occurring in a much larger and more fragmented media landscape, as new personalities and platforms make it much harder for any one outlet to change the narrative. Donald Trump's allies in the corners of the conservative media that are more loyal to him, including Breitbart, Newsmax, and Talk Radio, are already seizing on the turn inside Fox News as evidence of a betrayal. Donald Trump appears willing to fight. He blasted Fox and Friends this week on his social media service, Truth Social, for being terrible and having gone to the dark side after one of his hosts had mentioned that Ron DeSantis had beat Donald Trump in two recent opinion polls of a hypothetical 2024 Republican primary contest. Then, offering no evidence, he blamed Paul Ryan, the former Republican Speaker of the House, with whom he often clashed. Paul Ryan sits on the Fox Corporation's board of directors. The New York Post was often on Mr. Trump's side in its editorials when he was president, but it occasionally went against him, like when Donald Trump refused to concede the election in 2020 and the paper's front page headlines blared, "Mr. President, stop this insanity." Donald Trump found a home on Fox News when the network's founder, Roger Ailes, gave him a weekly slot on Fox and Friends in 2011. Mr. Trump used the platform to connect with the budding Tea Party movement as he thrashed establishment Republicans like Paul Ryan and spread a lie about the authenticity of President Barack Obama's birth certificate. Initially, neither Roger Ailes nor Rupert Murdoch thought of Donald Trump as a serious presidential candidate. Roger Ailes told colleagues at the time that he thought Donald Trump was using his 2016 campaign to get a better deal with NBC, which broadcast The Apprentice, according to Insurgency, this reporter's account of Mr. Trump's rise in the GOP. And when Ivanka Trump told Rupert Murdoch over lunch in 2015 that her father intended to run for president, Rupert Murdoch reportedly did not even look up from his soup, according to The Devil's Bargain by Joshua Green. But as Mr. Trump became bigger than any one news outlet and bigger than even his own political party, he was able to turn the tables and rally his supporters against Fox News or any other outlet he felt was too critical of him. He regularly used Twitter to attack Fox personalities like Megyn Kelly, Charles Krauthammer, and Karl Rove. The network could always be critical of him in its news coverage, but now the skepticism comes through louder. In asides from news anchors, in interviews with voters, or in opinion articles for other Murdoch-owned media properties. Referring to the congressional investigation into the 6th of January attack, the Fox anchor Brett Baier said it had made Donald Trump look horrific by detailing how it had taken 187 minutes for him to be persuaded to say anything publicly about the riot. One recent segment on FoxNews.com featured interviews with Trump supporters who were overwhelmingly unenthusiastic about a possible third campaign, saying that they thought his time has passed and that he was a little too polarizing. Then they offered their thoughts on who should replace Donald Trump on the ticket. Unanimously, they named Ron DeSantis. I spent 11 years at Fox and I know nothing. Pre-taped hits a Fox screen that hasn't been signed off on and sanctioned at the very top levels of management, said Eric Bolling, a former Fox News host who is now with Newsmax, especially when it has to do with a presidential election. There can be no denying that Fox News remains Fox News. Viewers in recent weeks have seen occasionally critical coverage of Donald Trump. But unlike other news networks, Fox has chosen to air its own primetime programming rather than the hearings of the committee investigating the January 6 attack on the Capitol. Tucker Carlson, Sean Hannity, and Laura Ingraham dismissed the hearings as a show trial. They are lying, and we are not going to help them do it, Tucker Carlson has said. What we will do instead is to try to tell you the truth. The network has aired the January 6 committee hearings during the day when far fewer viewers are tuning in. But other segments during the daytime and even evening play up violent crime in Democratic-run cities or Joe Biden's verbal and physical stumbles. As the government announced that a key indicator of economic health declined last quarter, the headline Fox scrawled across the screen read, Biden denies recession as U.S. enters recession. On 13th of April this year, Donald Trump called into Sean Hannity's show and ran through a list of crises he claimed would not be happening had we won this election, which we did. He hasn't been interviewed on the Fox News network ever since.
Yemeni men, firm faith.
Part 2.
Big dreams burn down in these flames. The dreams of a young man who wanted to conquer the world with petrodollars and an iron fist. June 21st, 2017, international media reported that a silent coup was underway in the corridors of power in Riyadh. King Salman, the ailing Saudi monarch, deposed Mohammed bin Nayef, the crown prince, and his nephew, and replaced him with his own son, Mohammed bin Salman. But for many, it wasn't news. On January 10th, 2016, The Independent had published an article from Germany's intelligence agency that said they expected King Salman to officially introduce bin Salman as his successor and delegate power. At that time, almost 10 months had passed since the Saudi aggression on Yemen. During the 10 months, the horrifying aspects of the humanitarian crisis came to light. On June 14, 2015, 2 months after the war, the UN Office for Humanitarian Affairs reported the spread of dengue fever in Yemen and the deaths of 113 people. Only a few weeks later, on July 1st, the UN described Yemen as the worst humanitarian crisis in the world, over 80% of the people needed immediate food and medical aid. The country is just one step away from famine. By besieging Yemen, bin Salman wanted to check the strength of the Ansarullah and Houthi forces and also trigger a popular uprising against the Ansarullah by cutting food supplies. Since the Saudi pilots weren't skillful enough, Saudi bombs would constantly target children, women, schools, and wedding ceremonies. Human Rights Watch reported that 309 civilians were killed in airstrikes until August 30th, 2015, less than 6 months since the war. What did Mohammed bin Salman want with this poor nation that's on the verge of famine? How would he benefit from the lethal and bloody airstrikes? Some believe that he had his big dream, the dream of turning Saudi Arabia into the biggest power in the region and turning himself into the most powerful man in West Asia. But his dream faced a big hurdle. Iran, a country that's naturally been the heavyweight in the region for centuries. The Saudis accused Iran of intervention in Yemen and seek to introduce Ansarullah as evidence of Iran's influence in the region. It seems history is repeating itself. The story of Iran in Yemen has started once again. Mohammed bin Salman received intelligence reports that Yemenis are making missiles, but the young crown prince was so confident about the super modern weapons purchase from the United States that he isn't worried about threats by the impoverished Yemen, especially now that he's managed to win support from various countries. For example, he sought approval from neighbors of Iran, Turkey, and Afghanistan for the Saudi invasion of Yemen. Among the Western countries, France, the UK, the US, and Canada all supported Saudi aggression. Among Islamic countries, Bangladesh, the Palestinian Authority, and even the Gaza Strip lent support for the Saudi raid. The support was the outcome of Mohammed bin Salman's diplomatic, political, and economic influence. However, Iran, along with Russia, Iraq, Syria, and the European Union, formed the opposition front. Oman didn't join the Saudi-led coalition and adopted a neutral stance. Indonesia, with the largest Muslim population, and China, with the largest population on the planet, didn't support the Saudi invasion either. Iran had adopted and active diplomacy to defend the national will of Yemenis. The other side of the war was the public opinion. Mohammed bin Salman wanted to depict a young and future-minded image of himself, a man who's come to reform his country. But his record in Yemen didn't help him portray the image. Even worse, two other developments made the dark side of his character more prominent. In the fall in 2017, another soft coup landed bin Salman in a secure place in the pyramid of power in Saudi Arabia. The incident is called the 2017 Purge. About 200 Saudi princes and businessmen were arrested and detained in the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Riyadh. According to news from Riyadh, Prince Walid bin Talal, a major Citibank and Twitter stockholder who's a known figure in English-speaking countries, was among the detainees. At that time, the New York Times carried a report on November 8th that the detention campaign was the latest move by the Crown Prince to grab power. Next year, some other news tarnished bin Salman's image all across the world.
If Saudi Arabia waited for Mr. Obama to approve an intervention in Yemen, Yemen would have been gone and lost long time ago.
A Saudi journalist named Jamal Khashoggi, after entering the Saudi consulate in Turkey's Istanbul, never came out and disappeared forever. The speculations and comments by Turkish officials said that he was killed. Khashoggi was one of the critics of bin Salman, but no one thought that the young crown prince would murder a journalist in such a gruesome manner without leaving a trace. The consequences of the incident were so harsh that even the U.S. Senate was forced to show a reaction. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee suspended selling arms to Saudi Arabia. The administration of Donald Trump had just taken the helm and had promised to boost job creation, didn't take the suspension seriously. In famous images, Donald Trump talks about selling arms to Saudi Arabia, and Mohammed bin Salman, who's sitting right next to him, seems to be very happy to be in this new situation.
But if you look in terms of dollars, $3 billion, $533 million, $525 million, that's peanuts for you. Should have increased it.
For bin Salman, Trump's coming to power meant purchasing more weapons. It meant public opinion had less effect on Trump. Without mincing his words, Trump said that he would continue selling arms to Saudi Arabia even after the Khashoggi murder. At the same time, the pressure on Tehran increased. The West accused Iran of sending weapons to Yemen, but Iran also had something to say. April 23, 2018, bombing a wedding ceremony in Yemen by Saudi fighter jets. The casualties were put at about 50. The bride was also one of the fatalities. It wasn't only Iran that felt the danger by Saudi Arabia. Qatar also cut off political ties with the Saudis for a while. Saudi Arabia had accused Doha of supporting terrorism. Even before that, in 1992, Saudi forces launched an attack on Qatar's border and killed two border guards and arrested another. As for Bahrain, Saudi Arabia had deployed its forces to the country to suppress an uprising in that country. The Bahraini people protested Saudi policies. The UAE, that's after business in the region, pursued goals that are different from Saudi Arabia's. Those policies caused rifts among the Houthi opposition forces. Now, they had to pay all of the costs for the Saudi war. This was what Iran had pointed out time and again. During this period, Abdulmalik al-Houthi was keeping a close eye on the developments. The media noticed that he looked very differently. This is not the Abdulmalik during the first days. He's become thinner and emaciated, just like other people in Yemen who are struggling with food shortages. His thin face shows a leader who shares his people's pain and suffering. Abdulmalik had 8 brothers, and he's younger than all of them. In terms of his personality, he's the polar opposite to Mohammed bin Salman. He's from a poor country and wants to defend his people against other Arab countries. These days, he's thinking of military strategies to deal a strike to Saudi Arabia, some strategies to cause concern for his enemy in Riyadh. The winter in 2015, when Ansarullah took control of the capital Sana'a, the Houthis recognized the Yemeni army's missiles, arsenal, and took possession of all of them. Different missiles were found in the arsenal, ground-to-ground short-range missiles that have a range of 120 kilometers and ground-to-ground medium-range missiles that have a range of 320 kilometers, in addition to 800 Russian Scud-B missiles. But in addition to all of them, Yemen has some missiles that can hit targets as far as 1,000 kilometers away and can easily target the Saudi capital, Riyadh. The West says Iran gave them the missiles, but what's the story? After the fall of Saddam Hussein, the Ba'ath Party was dismantled. However, Ba'ath military personnel went to different Arab countries. Then, Yemeni President Ali Abdullah Saleh hired 200 Iraqi military experts. They formed the body of Yemen's missile system with Iraq's experience and Russian missile systems in Iraq. The Chinese were also involved. On Tuesday, October 4th, 2016, when the U.S. announced that it was going to send 3 warships to the southern shores of Yemen. In fact, it was in response to Ansarullah's attack on an Emirati warship. The attack was carried out with a Chinese anti-tanker C-802 missile. The attack meant that the Ansarullah was now in control of Yemen's territorial waters as well. But the Ansarullah didn't just have missiles in its stockpile. Military drones are another part of the Ansarullah's equipment to fight Saudi Arabia. To track down the threat, Saudi Arabia uses ground-to-air Patriot missiles made by the U.S. that's scheduled to block any ground-to-ground missiles or drones. They're supposed to down the drones or to destroy them mid-air. Yet, the Patriot system has failed to counter Yemeni missiles on numerous occasions. Sometimes it's managed to track the Yemeni missiles, and other times failed to track them. On Saturday, September 14th, 2019, Ansarullah prepared to target Aramco oil facility in a major drone strike. Bukayik, in east of Saudi Arabia, is one of the centers of the Aramco state oil company. The Bukaik facilities prepare crude oil for shipment on supertankers. In order to transfer oil to other parts of the world in tankers, sulfide hydrogen has to be removed from it. Bukaik has the biggest facilities in the world for that purpose. Geographically, Bukaik is located in the east of Saudi Arabia, near Bahrain and Qatar and the Persian Gulf. Ansarullah drones have to cross a famous desert to reach Saudi Arabia. It's a vast desert that comprises a large part of Saudi Arabia. No village exists there, and no human beings live there either. It means this is the best and most secure option for an attack. Drones are the most inexpensive type of airstrikes, and all countries are in possession of them. Ansarullah has many drones for its operations, probably over 20 of them. The drones were equipped with missiles and flew in two groups. The first group reached above the facilities at 4 o'clock. The anti-missile systems were activated and started shooting, but they failed to down the drones. In the first wave, the storage facilities were set afire. After the first wave, firefighters were deployed to the site to douse the blaze. All of a sudden, the second wave of drone attacks started. The second group of Yemeni drones was above the stores. In the early hours, Bin Salman got the news and became agitated. This is a nightmare that Abdulmalik Houthi staged for Bin Salman. Soon, we received news that Bukaik was hit in the second wave of drone attacks. His big dreams are burning down in these flames. We don't know what the two rivals, Mohammed bin Salman and Abdulmalik Houthi, had in mind. But after sunrise, the massive aftermath of the attack came to light. 5% of the oil production in the world was lost, about half of Saudi Arabia's oil. And it happened exactly when the oil was supposed to be loaded into the tankers. The Houthis knew very well where they had targeted. The bigger target wasn't oil, but a feeling of insecurity for the Saudi officials and the image and position Saudi Arabia considered for itself as leader of the military coalition in the Yemen war. But it seemed that bin Salman was more cautious than angry. No crushing response to the Houthis. What would happen if the Houthis answered the Saudi reaction with a bigger attack? The Patriot missile system has failed to help Saudi Arabia so far, but if the Houthis are accused of the attack, that means that Saudi Arabia has conceded defeat.
It was an affront to international law, and those responsible should be held accountable for their actions.
After 5 years of war, now Abdulmalik al-Houthi has the upper hand. It was unacceptable for Mohammed bin Salman. So, unofficial sources, news agencies, and some Western countries are pointing the finger at Tehran.
If the Iranian regime and the IRGC, they are trying to hide any evidence from the component and with the technology, they are mistaken.
Whenever the Houthis gain a military achievement, Iran is accused. But is it Yemen strategic for Iran? Is a horizon on the Red Sea and Indian Ocean and Bab al-Mandab Strait strategically insignificant for Iran. Maybe centuries ago during the Sassanid era, Yemen had strategic importance for Iran, but today the equation has changed. Unlike the past, Iran does not need to be present in a sensitive strait like Bab al-Mandab. The Iranian people know full well what the best strategic weapon is: friendship with the people in other countries. If we view Iran's strategy in that light, the support for the Yemeni people who started the revolution and were attacked by the Saudis will be Iran's best strategic asset. An asset that threatens the greedy regional countries like Saudi Arabia, and it means the story isn't over yet.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
In the United States, a massive $1.6 billion defamation lawsuit by a voting machine company over Fox News election lies got a whole lot more serious last month when a judge ruled the action can proceed in a scathing ruling against media magnate Rupert Murdoch and his son. The article you're about to hear has been written by Huffington Post journalist Mary Papenfoss. The article was published by Huffington Post and is titled "Fox News Potentially Facing Major Financial Damage in Dogged Suit Over Election Lies." A massive $1.6 billion defamation lawsuit by a voting machine company over Fox News election lies got a whole lot more serious last month when a judge ruled the action can proceed in a scathing ruling against media magnate Rupert Murdoch and his son Lachlan. Dominion Voting Systems was given the green light in June to proceed in its lawsuit against both Fox News and Fox Corporation, its parent company, by Delaware Superior Court Judge Eric M. Davis. Judge Davis determined that it was a reasonable inference that Rupert Murdoch and his son Lachlan Murdoch either knew outright that Dominion had not manipulated the election or recklessly disregarded the truth when Fox disseminated lies initially launched by Donald Trump. Conservative news outlets, OAN and Newsmax, have also been sued by Dominion for defamation for $1.6 billion each. Dominion has a very strong case against Fox News. Chiara Torres-Spelisky, a constitutional law professor at Florida Stetson University and fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice, told The Guardian. All of the conspiracy theories about Dominion's machines were just pure bunk, she added. The Fox News Channel, as a news organization, should have known that and not given this aspect of Donald Trump's big lie a megaphone. What's particularly bad for Fox, she noted, is that Dominion asked the network to stop disseminating the lies and correct the record. Yet Fox persisted in spreading misrepresentations about the voting machine company. A particularly intriguing development could be the exposure of text and email messages among the Trump White House, Fox News personalities, and even Rupert Murdoch himself. I think once you start to pull the discovery material, what you're going to find is there was a lot of communication between the Trump people, both internally and externally, about pushing very specific lies and narratives. Angelo Carissoni, chief executive of Media Matters for America, told The Guardian. A Fox News Channel spokesman told the newspaper, "We are confident we will prevail in this case, as the First Amendment is the foundation of our democracy and freedom of press must be protected." Delaware judge on Thursday, 21st of July, denied Newsmax's motion to dismiss a $1.6 billion defamation lawsuit filed by Dominion Voting Systems alleging the network's reporting about the voting software company following the 2020 presidential election was false. Judge Eric M. Davis of the Superior Court of Delaware ruled Dominion at this stage has a case for defamation and allowed the company's lawsuit to advance. The complaint supports the reasonable inference that Newsmax either knew its statements about Dominion's role in the election fraud were false or had a high degree of awareness that they were false, Judge Eric Davis wrote in his decision. The judge also said Newsmax continued pushing election fraud claims even though the network knew the allegations were probably false. Newsmax possessed countervailing evidence of election fraud from the Department of Justice, election experts, and Dominion at the time it had been making its statements, Judge Davis wrote. Dominion sued Newsmax Media Incorporated on 9th of August 2021 for $1.6 billion, arguing the right-wing media company deliberately made false statements about the 2020 presidential election and Dominion voting machines. On the same day, Dominion filed two additional defamation lawsuits against One American News Network, OAN, and former Overstock.com chief executive officer Patrick Byrne. Newsmax told Huffington Post it was not surprised by last Thursday's ruling. The same judge ruled in December of 2021 that Dominion's $1.6 billion defamation lawsuit against Fox News could proceed. "We are not surprised by the judge's decision, as this was a preliminary motion, and he made a very similar ruling in the Fox News case," the company said in a statement. Newsmax reported on both sides in the election dispute without making any claim about the results, other than saying they were legal and final. "We are confident that Newsmax will ultimately prevail given the strong First Amendment protections provided to ensure free speech and a free press," the statement continued.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
At least 37 African migrants died recently when some 2,000 migrants tried to cross the high wire fence separating Spain's Moroccan enclave of Melilla from the northern Moroccan border town of Nadir. Moroccan security forces have been blamed for this tragic incident. An eyewitness to the killings speaks here of what transpired.
We went to the city next to Meir, and they beat us badly. They killed our friends and family. The Moroccan government said there were 23 dead, but we know there are more than 70. It's inhumane.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and it's always great welcoming you to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of news making headlines in Africa. Now, this week's edition is focusing on the tragic death of over 37 African migrants who lost their lives in a crash trying to enter the Spanish enclave of Melilla in northern Morocco. We're asking, who is responsible for the deaths of these innocent African civilians? The second part of our program today will be on Somalia's catastrophic famine. Lives of millions, including vulnerable women and children, are at risk if urgent measures are not taken to mitigate the unfolding humanitarian crisis.
African migrants killed in Morocco. At least 37 African migrants were killed recently while trying to scale a fence to enter Melilla, Spain's enclave in Morocco. Melilla and Ceuta, Spain's other tiny North African enclave, have the European Union's only land borders with Africa, making them a favorite target for migrants. Moroccan officials who guard the checkpoint claimed many were killed in the crush, with others seriously injured falling from the fence. Shocking video published by the Moroccan Association for Human Rights shows police officers beating helpless wounded migrants.
The United Nations, the African Union, and independent rights groups have denounced the use of excessive force by Moroccan and Spanish security personnel. A senior Kenyan diplomat at the United Nations says the killing of African migrants in Morocco was a blatant violation of a UN Human Rights Council resolution.
Exactly 2 years ago, the Human Rights Council adopted a resolution on the promotion and protection of the human rights and fundamental freedoms of Africans and people of African descent against excessive use of force and other human rights violations by law enforcement officers. What happened to the migrants trying to enter the Spanish enclave of Melilla is a blatant violation of this resolution. Rather than being protected, they were assaulted. Tragically, this was not an isolated incident. It is part of a worrying trend in recent years in which people of African descent traveling to Europe via the Mediterranean suffer extreme violations of their human rights.
Well, for more analysis on the recent killing of innocent African migrants in Morocco, we have contacted Mustafa Traore, an academic, political analyst, and the founder of AnOpenEye.org. Thanks a lot, sir, for your time today.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
Now, who is to blame for the latest tragic death of African migrants in Morocco?
Well, I think everyone is responsible for what happened. Poverty is one of the main reason why these people decided to go out from their countries, to leave their countries and try to have some kind of experience in the Western world. But what is the reason for the poverty they are going through back home? So this is a question I think we should ask ourselves. So I think many people, their government is responsible because it was not able to provide them with the jobs they needed just to live decently. Those causing the poverty, those who benefit from the poverty of the African continent are responsible. And of course, the authorities in Morocco, and I'm going to add Spain as well. So I think everyone is more or less responsible for what happened. The system has to change.
The United Nations has joined human rights groups in Morocco and Spain in calling for an independent investigation into the deaths of the 37 migrants.
We call on the two countries to ensure an effective and independent investigation is held as a first step towards establishing the circumstances of the deaths and injuries and any possible responsibilities, and to ensure that accountability is guaranteed as appropriate.
The state-backed National Human Rights Council of Morocco claims that Morocco says the African migrants who died in a mass attempt to enter the Spanish enclave of Melilla suffocated.
Human rights activists and campaigners say Morocco cannot be trusted with an independent probe, as it is working at the behest of Spain to use every means possible to stop the migrants. A protester in Spain says such massacres are likely to be repeated in future. Now, can we trust the Moroccan probe that said that the migrants likely suffocated?
Of course not. They have to find an excuse. But at the same time, I think that even for Moroccans, life in Morocco is difficult. And I'm not sure that they have the kind of democracy we think of. So I do not have the people of Morocco have the respect of their authorities. So how come a system that does not respect its own people, how come is it going to respect people coming from other countries, and especially when these people have dark skin?
Africa is mostly viewed as a continent of mass migration and displacement caused by poverty, violent conflict, and environmental stress. This is while Western multinationals continue to plunder the continent's natural resources. For instance, the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development says African economies are losing around $50 billion through illicit financial flows each year, with much of the damage rooted in trade misinvoicing of commodity exports. If such plundering by Western multinationals is halted, there will be no need for Africans to flee the continent.
The African continent is the richest continent on Earth. They have oil, they have gold, they have gas, they have all the resources, they have fruits, vegetables, everything can grow in the African continent. How come these people with the richest countries are leaving their homeland to try to have life or experience in the West? Well, I think this is what we have to target. When we study the system of all these countries, the agreements they have, and the policies that are put into place, the elections, we know that it is nothing else but corruption. So I think we have to fight against colonialism, corruption, and all these things, so that these people stay and remain in their back home.
The brutality meted out on African migrants has been condemned and termed by many activists as a pointer to double standards by Western countries, which have given preferential treatment to Ukrainian refugees.
The measures that can be taken are to open safe routes so that people want to ask for asylum can do so. This has been done for asylum seekers from other countries, from Ukraine. In 4 months, thousands of people have come to Spain. We do not understand why the same can be done for other countries.
Many migrants are leaving Africa to escape civil wars, violence, or persecution. There was an upsurge of violence and terrorism in Africa following the NATO-led military intervention in Libya in 2011. Now, this North African country lost control of a large part of the stockpiles it had amassed over 40 years. The transfer of weapons from Libya strengthened armed rebel movements across West Africa and Sahel countries that are now a major source of migrants to Europe. Now, what is the role of Western countries in igniting the current migrant crisis in Africa?
It is very simple. When you look at all these countries, these Africans are fleeing. None of them is a manufacturing country in terms of weapons. None of them manufacture weapons. So it tells us a lot. Who are those selling the weapons? Who are those creating chaos? who are those, in fact, benefiting from all this situation. I'm going to take the case of Libya because we need very concrete examples. Libya, it used to be a peaceful land under Gaddafi. Now, what is the situation? Now, you have different groups fighting one another. And at the same time, you have some countries exploiting the oil.
The over-reliance on external aid in many African countries has resulted in many leaders neglecting their responsibility to serve their communities by failing to create environments that allow their people to thrive. This neglect has allowed Western powers continue looting the continent's resources.
And now my last question. What can African countries do to stop this migrant crisis?
Well, I think the best example today is what is happening in Mali. So we need leaders who are aware of the situation. And this goes through Pan-Africanism. For the first time since a long time ago, we have in the African continent a government, the Malian government, the army, trying to put into place a system of Pan-Africanism. And we see all the trouble, all the things, all the stabbing that many countries are trying to do.
Well, our guest there says that the only way for African countries to develop is by ending the plundering of the continent by Western powers. I'd like to thank our guest, Mr. Mustafa Traore, for his insight. We'll now take a short break before our next topic, which is on Somalia's catastrophic famine. Stay with us.
Somalia's catastrophic famine.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
The worst famine in decades is ravaging the Horn of Africa region, destroying crops and driving the cost of food out of reach of many.
In Somalia alone, 7 million people out of a total population of 16 million could be at risk of famine in the next 2 months if aid is not scaled up to meet skyrocketing needs. As Somalia enters its fifth consecutive season without enough rain, aid agencies are calling on world nations to take action and save lives.
A UNICEF official says Somalia and other countries in the region are suffering the brunt of climate change created by industrialized countries.
The Horn of Africa has extremely arid spots where communities struggle to survive. The situation is worsening, and children and their families are being worn down year after year with no time for recovery between climate shocks. The unfairness of it all is that these countries are least responsible for creating climate change, and they're bearing the heaviest brunt. Somalia, for example, is responsible for only 0.01% of the world's carbon dioxide emissions, but it's ranked as the fourth worst affected country in UNICEF's Global Children Climate Risk Index. I've been to Somalia recently and saw very closely the devastation caused by drought. In many parts of the country, no water, no livelihoods, only despair. I heard of children being buried along the roads as their families make desperate long treks to seek help. And we fear the worst is just around the corner.
To discuss the unfolding famine situation in Somalia, we contacted Tunde Osazua, a member of the Africa team at the Black Alliance for Peace. Thanks a lot, sir, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Now, the famine in Somalia was predictable. So why is the world letting people die in this forsaken Horn of Africa country?
It was very predictable. And Somalia faces the worst food crisis in the world. But the response to this catastrophe that was really created by the West has been to cut economic aid to Somalia, to carry out drone bombings in the country, and more recently, to return 500 U.S. troops to Somalia, which really represents another effort on the part of the U.S. and the West to deny agency and independence to the Somali people. Really, since 1991, the U.S.-led West has kept Somalia destabilized and really in a perpetual state of civil war, which has resulted in a million deaths. And the West's goal is to make the country an ungovernable killing ground where Somalis can't use their own resources, whether that be oil or uranium, to develop their country or deal with famine or droughts or other environmental crises on a national level.
Somalia has one of the highest numbers of internally displaced persons in the world, estimated at 2.9 million people in 2022, of whom 2.2 million require urgent humanitarian assistance. One of the displaced persons speaks here on the dire situation.
The situation around here is extremely difficult. People are hungry and in poor health. People don't even have shelter. Every time a car passes here, people think that somebody is coming to give them food.
When Western governments pledge aid money, it is rarely handed directly over to poor countries such as Somalia, despite the rhetoric about how much money is given each year. Pablo Yanguas, the author of Why We Lie About Aid, Development and the Messy Politics of Change, says many Western aid agencies actually lie about the aid they give to poor countries.
We lie about aid because it's very hard not to lie about aid, because the politics in donor countries have become so vicious against the aid sector, and the demands on transparency and accountability have become so onerous that the only way that the aid sector can survive is by fudging the reality about what they do. And that is essentially why we lie about aid.
Somalia is a classic case of how humanitarian assistance is used to perpetuate neo-colonialism. Dozens of Western humanitarian agencies have been operating in Somalia for decades, yet there is no end in sight to the suffering of Somalis.
Yeah, so the U.S.-led West, under the cover of humanitarianism, intervened in Somalia in a number of instances to advance the interests of oil companies, of multinational energy corporations. As the top World Bank petroleum engineer remarked at the time of some of those interventions, Somali oil had high potential, and it provided that Somali citizens could get their act together, they could really deal with a lot of issues they're facing. But that hasn't played out due to the influence, really, of some of these international actors. And the 500 U.S. troops that were sent to Somalia in May are a more recent attempt to violate the sovereignty of that country and to prevent any robust response to the crises that they're facing.
Somali legislators elected former leader Hassan Sheikh Mohamud as the country's president following a long overdue election in the troubled Horn of Africa nation. Now, he used his inauguration speech to appeal to the diaspora and international community to help stave off famine that threatens this drought-stricken country. He also noted that one of the main challenges the country faces is insecurity, which has also impacted